Good evening.
Hello.
Hello. Who do I have with me on the call so far?
This is Lisa.
Lisa, good to have you here. And who else is here?
Hi, Paulina Yan just joined.
Elena just joined, and who else?
Liz.
Just joined. Good to have you here, Liz. Whoop. Is Carol here?
I'm here.
All right. And Ellen?
Ellen is here.
Good. How about Chris? Chris. Saidu?
Yep, I'm here.
Very good. All right. So I'm just missing Chris. Hopefully he'll be along very shortly. So welcome back, guys. We are now going to have a discussion about week two of our DISC program. We have some background noise going on. This may be somebody in the kitchen maybe do some cooking. If that's you, if you could just hit star six, that would mute us out. Appreciate that very much. Let's just check and see if there are any burning questions left over from week one, things you were just dying to ask either during class or after class and didn't get a chance to. No burning questions? All right. Did everyone get access to Dropbox? They could pull down the recording and the session two slides.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
All right, good. And I assume that beep is Chris checking in, is that right?
Yes. Hello, Dave. How's it going?
That's going great. How are you doing, Chris?
Great. Nice rainy weather out here, huh?
Yeah, it is. It's raining. It's rained last night, rained again today, so it's kind of nice, actually. As long as it doesn't turn into snow, I'll be happy.
Cool.
Yeah. So I was just talking about for any burning questions from last week, and if everyone had access to Dropbox, so they all got a chance to get down the pull down the slides and pull down the recordings. The slides will be out there again for week three, no later than Thursday, along with the recording, which we usually use up sooner than that, actually. There'll be at least one file I send you guys over the next couple weeks that's just way, way, way too big to send through email. Which is why I prefer to use the Dropbox method. It's easier to pull things down. I'm going to give you guys a recording of a 30-minute speech about DISC. And it's a speech that I use to give in public at events, like in front of Chamber of Commerce, in front of Rotary groups, that kind of stuff about DISC. It's called The Story of the Four Knights. And Knights is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T-S. Or if you're a Monty Python fan, that would be for Knigets. But something you guys can use yourself, if you decide to go out and do more DISC work, you can modify the story and have basically a 30-minute public speech ready to go in very short order for yourselves. So,
cool.
Big file. So you'll need to have Dropbox for that.
Right on. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's cool.
When is that going to come?
Usually I put it out there after week five.
Okay, cool.
Do we have a chance to kind of review things and how things are working through? You know, today we're going to talk about the D's and the I's. Next week, the S's and the C's. And then we get into some interesting stuff where we're talking about combinations of behaviors together. And when I get through that stuff, that's the real, real, real meaty stuff. Then I put that out there afterwards. But it's a cute story. And I gave it in public a lot, and I'll just give you guys a little clue here. I also recorded it for a reason. I recorded it because people would sit there and say to me things like, I really enjoyed that speech. I wish my, you know, boss, friend, neighbor, whatever it was, could hear it. So I recorded the speech, and then I stuck it in a nice CD label kind of stuff. And people would say, oh, well, yeah, I wish my boss had heard that speech. I'd say, here. And give them the CD. Because on there, of course, was my name and contact information. And they wouldn't generally throw it away. It would sometimes get passed around from person to person, and I'd hear about it later. So it's a good tool to have to market DISC as well.
Cool.
All right. So let us get into reviewing session one. Can anyone here give me a brief history, overview of DISC?
Okay. It was started in 1972 by a man named William Marston. It's got four primary styles, which it didn't have at the beginning, but now has 12 ED styles as well. It measures behaviors and intelligence. No, it doesn't measure intelligence, desire, value, strength. I'm reading that part. It measures behaviors.
Good. Anybody care to add in some color and detail? All right, well, a little correction there. Dr. Marston wrote the book, The Emotions of Normal People, in 1928. That was the basis for DISC. 1972, researchers at the University of Minnesota created the first profile. So Dr. Marston's theories, University of Minnesota actually wrote the first profile in 1972.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
All right. So why is it important that we understand what DISC does not measure?
Because we shouldn't use it for thinking that it can judge people's intelligence or their experience or what they're willing to learn or how they learn or their education or anything like that.
Yeah.
Or anything they've already been through.
So it's a great tool for measuring certain things, but it's not all-encompassing. And occasionally you're going to hear about things people sit and say, well, I don't want you to put me into a box and try to tell me everything about me because there's these four little things here. No. It's certain things that measures, that it measures very well, does not measure everything about you. Just certain key things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Good. Can somebody here explain the Joe Harry window to me?
Okay. it's a system of communication. It's a tool used for communication in four different, identifying four different areas, but trying basically to open up the arena wider by knowing and understanding the mask and the blind spots, the potential and the arena.
So a basic four-quadrant model, used a lot for communication, but other things as well, but it helps them understand how we communicate better. I understand what we do know and don't know about each other or about the future in this community. So the arena is the area that you know and I know. It's the area most comfortable communicating in because we both have common ground there. But there are areas that you may know about me that I don't know, my blind spots. So I may not be aware of things that I'm doing. And do you think some people have blind spots out there?
Absolutely.
All my friends have these blind spots. I'm lucky I don't have any. But they have all these blind spots. Things they don't realize about themselves that others realize, and it can hold back communication. It can hold back relationships. Likewise, there are things about me that I know that I've not yet shared with you. And maybe some things I'm holding back intentionally, maybe some things we just haven't gotten to yet. But in any event, since I know and you don't, those things are masked from your view. As I reveal them to you and enlarge that area again of the arena, it can improve our communication. And then, of course, neither one of us understands, knows about the future, So we can't talk to the future. Good. All right. Let us move right along then and talk a little bit here about the behavioral style chart. And then we're going to, and it's really fairly straightforward. The behavioral style chart is going to be the key to understanding DISC. Now, I will tell you that it's a very powerful chart to be able to draw. Now, you've got here with a circular model, which is really very nice. The key really are the crossed lines, if you will, the four quadrants. And if you look at first the upper half and lower half, it does kind of show you the concept of the area of people that are active, fast paced, and assertive in the upper half of the model, and those that are more reserved, moderate pace, and up on the bottom side of the model. And then the left hand side shows those that are task-oriented, questioning, and skeptical. With the right side, those that are more people-oriented, accepting, and agreeable. Now, this chart, if you talk to people about DISC in public, this chart is really easy for you to draw and very easy for you to begin to talk to the natural way people fall out in the universe, if you will. And just I'll share with you a small secret that I learned pretty early, but I know a lot of folks didn't. So I had this really pretty chart, and I made it all nice and colorized, and I printed it out, and I put it in one of those vinyl cover things, so it was all nice and pretty, so I could show it to folks and really impress them with how nice it looked. Yeah, that didn't work very well for me for some reason. The prettier it was didn't seem to make any difference to whatsoever. But I could draw that little pattern on a napkin over lunch and talk my way through it as I was drawing it. People were very, very impressed. So this little model here, very powerful sales tool for you, because it's going to help you explain how DISC is and how DISC works. But it was much more preferable when I drew it by hand, say on the back of a napkin. I drew it on a whiteboard in somebody's lunchroom. Those were much more impressive than the really pretty things that we're trying to hand out. No one seemed to want those. But as I walked through it and talked through it, it took 10 minutes to do that, people grasped it and they liked it. So my suggestion to you guys is that you really practice this model, study this model, so you can draw it by hand and talk about, as we talked here about the top half and the bottom half, the left and the right, and then talk about the fact that the upper left-hand quadrant, people are more active, fast-paced, assertive, same time, have a task orientation, are more questioning and skeptical. Those are your high Ds. And talk about what that means. Explaining that way with a drawing is a very effective way to get people to understand and engage in discussion about behavioral styles. And that round, the fact that the circle now is round, it used to be we had these three different charts, that really shows the continuum of styles to styles. And people tend to blend from one into the next. And that's become a very important part of our discussion going forward here. So draw the squares, if you will, the four quadrants. Let's circle around to show the continuum. It's a very powerful way of making sure people understand what this model is really going to look like and how they are going to apply, likely be more than one style at a time. You can also overlay very easily on this Dr. Marston's original model about how people dealt with the world around them. Were they more powerful than the environment, the upper half, less powerful, the lower half? Was the environment primarily a positive place, the right-hand side? primarily a negative place, the left-hand side. So you can overlay Dr. Marston's model on there very easily and help them see progression from one to the other. Keep in mind, as you look at that model, you've got some opposites on there. The D and the S are on opposite ends of the spectrum, if you will. The D being active, fast-paced, but skeptical, challenging, results-oriented, versus the S, more thoughtful, reserved, and people-oriented, and agreeable. Those are really opposites. Doesn't mean these one's better than the other or one's worse, but they have a different view of the world. Likewise, the I and the C. The I, again, being active, fast-paced, and assertive, at the same time being people-oriented, accepting, and agreeable, versus the C, which is, again, the more slower, thoughtful pattern for the task orientation, questioning behaviors. So the I and the C are opposites. What you're going to discover is that even though they're opposites, both the D and the S and the I and the C, they'll have some things actually in common. For example, both the I and the C, we'll get this little detail a little more later on here, both the I and the C can be heavily verbal. So you may get a lot of talking out of the I or the C. When the I talks, it's primarily about a people orientation, the excitement, the active, the fun stuff that they do. When the C tends to talk, it tends to be much more about the details and step-by-step of the process. But they may both talk a lot. So we'll cover that a little more thoroughly as we go along here. But even though they're opposites, the D and the S and the I and the C, they'll have some things they may have in common. All right. Before we get into our first discussion about the high Ds, are there any questions about what we've done so far?
I'm afraid that this is Ellen, and I am afraid that this is going to be a stupid question, so I'm going to ask it anyway, because there's so many different things that the letters refer to, and I'm wondering if there is something that is the more common trend that D, I, S, and C stand for.
You're going to want to hold with one name if you possibly can as you first start calling it out. I will tell you that Inscape likes to talk about the D being dominant.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it's Wiley. I stopped using the word dominant personally for the D a number of years ago because I was starting to make presentations on disk, and I didn't have any material myself, so I was making up on my own, and I was looking for some images. I Googled the word dominant. Not the best thing I've ever done in my entire life.
Okay.
If you're not sure what that means, try Googling dominant images and see what you get. I'll just tell you, a lot of women in black leather with whips, that's what you get.
Fantastic.
That's not what I was looking for exactly.
Right.
So I like the word driver for the D. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I like the word influencer for the I.
Okay.
Because they have the ability to talk to you and influence you in ways you hadn't thought possible. I like the word steady for the S.
Okay.
I like the word conscientious for the C.
Okay, so mostly the top ones that are then put in the chart.
Those are the ones I like the best, yeah.
Okay, great.
In other words,
you can use,
but that's the easy way to describe it.
Okay, I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Other questions? All right, let's jump in and get some real meat here on the high D. Now, as we talk about each of the four styles, we're going to look at both at the styles from two sides, what I call the best of that behavior and the worst of that behavior. because some people tend to associate certain styles with being good and others with being bad. And that really is not true. A lot of it comes down to how it really is used. So we're going to talk over here about the general background of the person, the characteristics about the person, how to recognize them, the words, the actions that they say, the words they may use, the surroundings you may find them in. We'll also discuss a little bit here the natural fear and emotion of each one, and the communication style as well. And again, we'll start by looking at the best, then from the best perspective, and then from the worst perspective. So, the high D, at their best, the high D is confident and self-assured. They are natural leaders who are willing to charge the hill. They tend to be adventurous. They get bored with routine stuff and like to shake things up. Change is a natural part of their makeup, and they're willing to change things if they see a better way. They also tend to be inquisitive, but often believe that they know the answer before they even ask the question. So that confidence and that self-assurance lead them to think they have all the answers, but at their best, they'll ask the questions and they'll hear answers. They may even adapt new answers, but they think they already know. And again, keep in mind that we don't measure intelligence here, so they may really know, they may not really know, but they're going to think that they know. Let's talk a little bit about an example. So Sam is a fast-rising executive at a large multinational company. His reputation as someone who gets things done and gets results. He's always looking for a better way to do things, and he often finds them. So he makes improvements in things, makes things better, and he's known as someone who makes things better. Sam surrounds himself with other talented, take-charge kind of people. He delegates to them because he trusts them and knows that they're going to be willing to get things done as well. All right. Now, what is Sam's challenge? Well, his support from his executive team is somewhat thin, those around him, because while his results have always been outstanding, he has not done a good job of building relationships with his immediate superiors. No one believes they truly know Sam, and therefore the executives aren't willing to put their reputations on the line to promote him. Okay, so his confidence, he's self-assured, he gets results, he makes things happen, he makes changes, but he doesn't tend to build relationships. In fact, it's even possible as he's doing this, people can be put off by his constant change. So does Sam here sound familiar to you? People you know who might be like that?
Yes, I do.
Sure.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And you want them around, don't you? Because they make things happen.
Yeah, they get stuff done.
They get stuff done, right. But they're not always good at building support.
Mm-hmm.
Now, oftentimes these people who are the high D's at their best, they have great support from those beneath them because they take good care of their people. People know that the boss is going to listen to them, hear their ideas. It's their boss also likes them a lot because the boss knows that the D is going to make them look good by getting results. They don't have corporate support around them. So we'll talk about coaching them in a few minutes. But one of the areas you can coach them around is the importance of relationships. You know, if you guys have worked in corporate world, you can go so far based on your own brains and ability to get things done. After that level, at a certain place in an organization, it's much more about relationships. So that's the high D at their best. Let's talk about the high D at their worst. So at their worst, they can appear to be aloof and arrogant. They make demands of their subordinates, do not recognize good performance, often find faults, and seldom give praise. The proponents of change, they believe they know better than those around them, so they make decisions unilaterally. They can appear to be cold and insensitive. They tend to communicate in short, loud bursts, and seldom take the time to explain their decisions and get their buy-in. Does that sound familiar to anybody out there? Know somebody like that?
Yep, I do.
That's the same high D we talked a minute ago about being aggressive and outgoing and getting things done and taking charge, but here this person has got a different perspective on it. The same high D, but not nearly as positive. Let's talk about an example of high D at their worst. So Susie's a VP at a mid-sized company. She's in charge of operations and views that as her personal kingdom. She came in from the outside with a resume that demonstrated one crowning achievement after another. In her old company, refused promoter. She's a problem solver, moves from one problem area to another, flies in like a tornado, eliminates underperformers and dead wood, improves the bottom line and productivity, and then moves on to the next challenge. Team below her lacks talent, and her successes can almost always be attributed to her strong will and determination. Susie's challenge, well, as you might guess, she's wearing out her welcome in operations. A number of key employees have left the organization. There's no other place for her in the organization at her level, and she believes her talents are being underutilized. Hence, she comes in for coaching. Yeah, I've had clients just like Susie. And I'm sure you guys will as well. Again, the same basic behavioral style as that D at their best, but without the ability to control it and use emotional intelligence around it, they tend to be whirlwinds, tornadoes, and not in a good way. So questions about the basic description of a high D. You have a good visual for that high D, going back to the model about being aggressive and outgoing and assertive, same time being task-oriented, questioning, skeptical, how that plays into both the high D at their best and the high D at their worst.
Yeah. It's like their passion. It's like their passion is their opportunity.
Ooh, tell me more about that.
Well, they're so passionate about getting results, getting things done, working through everything that it becomes the opportunity, and that they lose focus on those around them. So the visual that comes to mind for me is I see like somebody just plowing forward ahead toward the goal, and then you turn around and you see papers flying, bodies everywhere, just kind of like that's the visual that I get when I think of a D.
And especially, like you said, in the corporate arena, which I have been in for 27 years, I have had my share of D's. And that's what I see.
There you go.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And Liz, you hit upon something very important there that really holds true for all of the natural styles. So every natural style has its natural strengths, the high D, the ability to get things done, the ability to get results, the ability to cut through the crap and get the bottom line. D's excel at that. Here's the telling sign for any of the styles. Any strength of the style that is overused turns into a weakness. So when you're too focused on results, too focused on making changes, too focused on getting things done, you tend to leave a tornado, wake up a tornado in your path. That strength of getting things done turned into a weakness. You focus on that too much, not enough of the other parts of your behavior, and now you got a problem. So overused strengths turn into a weakness. All right. Now, surprisingly enough, there are some high D coaches out there. You're giggling, you probably know some just like that, right? So, as a coach, it's important if we're a high D and a coach that we understand our natural tendencies and be able to sit back and say, how can I be effective as a coach, understanding my tendencies and the fact that any overused strength can become a weakness. So as a coach, the high D can sometimes be too direct and therefore off-putting. So in our class on coaching at CTA, we talk about questions being open-ended, short, and direct. Direct questions are really the best kind of questions. But if the coach is too direct, too powerful, too in your face, that can scare a client away. Likewise, as they're listening and the focus they have on results and getting things done, they may miss the emotional undertones of whatever the challenge is. And as we all know, again, from our coaching class, those emotional undertones, that's your coachable moment. That's where you want to dig deep. So a high D coach may want to go from what's the problem to what's the solution, without digging deep into the coachable moment, finding out why it's a challenge, and therefore resolving the bigger issue. Again, as a coach, they may try and force that shift too quickly. They will see what has to get done. They know where it's going, and they want to drive you there. And we can't get there. The client has to get there before the coach does for it to really be effective. There can be too much focus on tasks and actions. Again, the issue of we see what the problem is, let's focus on the results as opposed to focusing on what the underlying cause is. They also may want to give advice. Again, high D's think they have the answers. Because they have the answers, they want to share the answers. I'm being a good coach. I'm going to share my wisdom with this client. Except that's not really what the coach is there for. So they may tend to want to give advice. And because of their task orientation and the results orientation, they're going to assume others have that as well. So they may not check in as an accountability partner with their client, assuming things happen. So those are natural tendencies of a high D as a coach. Doesn't mean they're always true, but they're the natural tendencies. If you're a high D coach, you want to be aware of these tendencies and be able to balance them, understand the tendency, and therefore back off on it as appropriate. Any high D coaches out there?
Yep.
I think they are. I do believe they're not many.
Do you believe it's not you? What you said?
No, I believe that. I said I believe they are out there, but they're not many.
Hmm.
Or they wouldn't be many.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
I say this because I took a course a couple of years ago, and we had to do an assessment to which would show you if you had the characteristics or traits to be a good coach or a different coach, And some of these tendencies we just discussed of a high D would probably not make fit into those the ideal coach.
Okay, well, that's a good point, because some of these tendencies, if they're not corralled by the coach, they can make you into a very ineffective coach.
Yes.
Again, if you're too direct with your clients and hit them in the face, that's not going to help them. If you miss that emotional undertone, that's going to be a problem as well. But so we talk about the high D at their best and at their worst. The high D coach at their best can be a very effective coach because they'll listen to those emotional undertones, and the tenacity that they have to get results will actually apply that portion as well. So they'll hear the emotional undertone because they'll learn to listen for it, and they won't let it go. Client tries to skate away on some other, it's not really a problem type thing, that high D may sit there and say, yeah, it is a problem, let's go back to it. So keep in mind that all the styles are going to have their natural strengths and weaknesses, and if they're played right, it'll be very effective. So are a lot of high D coaches? I'm not sure if I'd say a lot of them or not. There's not a lot of high Ds in the population in general. But they can be very effective as coaches. By the way, in the general U.S. population, the high D consists of about 3% of the overall population.
I was very surprised to read that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is, when you work in the corporate world, you tend to see a lot more of them, because they tend to aggregate and congregate in those areas. From the general population, it's only about 3% are high Ds, which is probably a good thing. Too many high Ds would create too much chaos, I think. That's my first opinion, though.
I'll drink to that, boy.
Too many high Ds, you would be drinking a lot, actually. That's what
As a high S, I can honestly say I would think they didn't authentically care about what my problem was.
Really?
If they showed up. Yeah, if they were direct and in my face and forcing issues and trying to get me focused on tasks and results and giving me answers, I'd wonder if they were really hearing me.
Okay. That's a really good point. So that high D at their worst as a coach is not one I'd want to be with either. So, yeah, they could especially as a high S, again, that opposite style, a high D can be very intimidating to a high S.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. And I am talking about them at their worst, not as a coach necessarily.
Right. So also in general population, you also find a lot of high Ds married to high Ss.
Oh, maybe that's why my ex might have been.
Yeah, that was my next question. What's the divorce rate amongst them?
Huge.
Well, and we discussed the high Ss. We're going to see some of that. Some of that may actually be true. All right.
I have a
I have a quick question just on the style. I noticed that, so for the model, the way we're learning it, we're focusing on the extreme, it looks like, high I, high D, high S, right, for each of them. And I'm just curious, given that my assumption is for most of the styles, the high at the bleeding edge is going to be a smaller population than the middle, which is going to be somewhere in between that spectrum of the extreme. So because there could be a tendency, since we're looking at the exaggerated version of positive and negative, to associate those kind of hyperbole, right, when we're working with people, when in fact they're mostly in the middle. So I'm just curious on why it's at the bleeding edge versus coming from the middle and then extrapolating out.
Okay, that's a good question. We talk about the DIS and C at these extremes, both positive and negative, to help understand the very different way that they view the world around them and interact. And that's what happens in weeks 2 and week 3 of this program. Week 4 and 5, we move much more toward the collaboration between the different styles, how they change, how they interact.
Okay. So that brings us more to the kind of middle ground, if you will.
It does. And okay. but your question, Lisa, is important, because people who have not been trained in DISC, who read a book someplace or read the profile themselves and use that only, and to focus on only those extremes.
Yeah.
We get into weeks 4 and 5, we get into those combinations. That's where you're going to stand out from your other DISC practitioners and be much more attuned to what really is going on and much more effective.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Good. All right. Let's talk about the high D as a client. Well, if you have a client who's a high D, good news is they tend to be very action-oriented. So if they've come to you and said, please be my coach, which I wouldn't use the word please, by the way, be my coach, you can be pretty well assured that they want to do something to change. They realize there's a problem someplace, and they're anxious to do something about it. So they are going to take an action orientation. High Ds also tend to not worry about mistakes. So if they've got an action and they do it and they realize it didn't work out right, high Ds tend to sit there and say, okay, that didn't work, what's next? What else should I do? So high Ds tend to not dwell on their mistakes, but that's a learning issue. Okay, I've done that, it failed, what's next? What do I have to do? That makes them very positive. They have a blind spot. They have massive blind spots around how others perceive them. All of us tend to perceive ourselves based on our thoughts and emotions rather than our actions. So the action orientation of a high D can be so aggressive and off-putting, but their intentions are good, therefore they don't see how others perceive them. Likewise, they may miss the emotions of others. So as a client, when you're talking to a client about things that are going on in their life and the actions they're going to take, they have to be cognizant of the fact that action they're going to take is going to have an impact on others and how that will impact them. So that focus then turns into discussing how they interact with others around them, because their general interaction makes demands rather than requests of people, simply in the way they put it. It comes across like an order rather than as a request. So people are a little more resentful when they're told these things. Likewise, they don't like being told what to do. So in their interaction with others, if they're on the receiving end of that high D behavior themselves, someone telling them what to do, they may rebel against it. So some of the challenges of coaching a high D, first of all, they tend to be the ones who are called sent to you because they say, my boss told me I need coaching. That's why I'm here. that's the alarm off my head goes ding, 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 ding. This is a problem because they don't think that they need coaching. When they come to you and say, I'm having a challenge and I need some help, you help me, that's a high D I want to work with because they're the ones who acknowledge they need coaching. Also of the high D, the challenge with coaching the high D client, they tend to act before they think. Even the session themselves, they'll talk about their actions. You have to pause them and say, so how's that going to impact people around you? How will it impact what your boss told you, or what your employees are saying, or what your spouse is saying, or your children? Sometimes the high D can view coaching as something that's soft, not tangible, and therefore not of a whole lot of value. And again, when they're sent to me for coaching, I have less interest in those people than the ones who say, I think I need some help. Can you help me? So there are some questions to keep in the back of your mind. If your client is a high D, questions you're going to ask them. So questions they're going to like to hear, what are you going to do about it? They like the kind of question. It refers to action orientation. They're going to respond well to that and grab onto it. But you also want to ask them, how is what you're going to do here going to impact others around you? Now, when you ask that question of a high D, it is going to give them pause. They're going to go, I hadn't thought about that. And they'll work their way through that and realize that they have to be careful of those around them. Or they might also say, who cares? Or why would it impact somebody else? If they slow them down, think about impacting other people, how others might perceive that, and how it's going to either further their cause or maybe not further their cause. You want to ask the question of the high D, are there other alternatives? They tend to make an action orientation, so the first thing that pops in the mind is what they want to do. Oh, I should just do this. Are there alternatives? Are there other things you might do instead? To help them think through not just one possible action, but a series to help find the best solution. What do you need as a result? Great question for the high D. And you can talk there about the result in terms of the output, but also in terms of the impact on others. So this question they're going to relate to, you're going to get deeper with them by asking them, what's the impact on others? What's the result with others as well? And when can you do this? They'll relate to that as well. Sometimes you'll hear, I'm doing it right now. I'll do it as soon as the call is over. That action orientation is very, very important to them. But they want to hear that question, when can you do this? Because they want to show you they're getting it done right away. So questions on our high D? Do you like the high Ds?
Sure.
they're a good challenge.
I think they generally tend to be people who you don't like, but you appreciate because they get the job done. They're hard workers, at least in a corporate environment.
I don't know if I like them or... Sorry.
Bad. Sorry.
I don't know if it's that you don't like them or you just can't relate. You don't understand where they're coming from.
Okay, I agree. That's better. Yeah, that would be better. Yeah.
Yeah.
Life is too strong.
For a high D, they have professional clarity where they're coming from. They know exactly what they're doing.
I think I something channel that they talk. Sorry.
There's a background, like paper shuffling, something like that going on.
I think that something that was in the reading that was real indicative of what you just said was that as communicators, they don't use a lot of words, so that tends for everybody to try to fill in and assume what they're meaning. So I think that's where people start perceiving what they are, and they often come across as misunderstood because they don't tell their own story or their intention.
So that's really a good insight.
Very true.
That lack of verbiage, if you will, from a high D leaves a lot of blanks, and people tend to fill them in. And I'll tell you a story in a different session. I don't have time for it right now, but a person I work with who was a high S, and they got a communication from their boss, and they said, God, my boss just hates me. This is so terrible. They hate me. And they showed me the communication, and it was a typical high D email written by someone who was a high D but trying very hard to over-communicate. And they basically paraphrased the person with a note. And I said, what do you think this note means? He thinks I'm stupid, and he thinks I'm incompetent. He said, you know what I think this note means? I think this note means, okay. And I forced her to go off and talk to her boss right then, in the middle of the session, and just assume that the note meant okay. She came back and went, my God, you were right. It did mean okay. I had no idea. So, yeah. That creates some real challenges. All right, let's move on to the high eye, because high eyes are fun. And again, we'll talk about the high eye at their best and at their worst. So at their best, the high eye is upbeat and energetic. They are master communicators. Keep you enthralled for hours with their stories. They can sell ice to the Eskimos. They're natural leaders as well. The energy of the high eye is contagious and spreads to everyone around them. They're quick to smile, quick with a joke, and always looking to have fun at work or away from work. They have good instincts about people and surround themselves with people who are anxious to make a difference. Their natural charm, powers of persuasion, make them peacemakers at home or at the office. They like to go out and have a good time. They often find themselves at the center of attention, even when no one knows who they are. You know some folks like that?
Yes, very, very well.
Yeah. And it makes you smile. Think about it. You're like, oh, man, I have such fun in Sally's presence. She's so much fun to be around. Everything's always hopping. But, you know, people like that need coaching as well. So here's our example. So Susie really seems to have found a home in marketing and advertising. Because she's full of creative ideas, she makes good connections with customers, and loves the flexibility and travel that comes with her new job. Her work is unstructured, which fits her personality perfectly. It often consists of working with a team of other creative people, walking around their creative space together, bouncing ideas off each other, and having a good time. Now, being a manager, there's always paperwork to get done, but she could easily recharge her batteries by meeting with friends after work for dinner and a few drinks. So, what's her challenge? Why has she called you? Well, managing the budgets for all these projects that she's working on does not exactly play to her strengths. And that project-by-project cost analysis, the kind of part wants done for each and every account she's working on, I have to wait till she's in the right mood, which is not going to be soon. She doesn't like paperwork when it interferes with her creative juices. Besides, just last night after work, she made 3 new best friends. So, the high eye at their best, energetic, outgoing, they're going to have challenges as well. And the first challenge is to recognize what the challenge really is. In this case, yeah, all those jobs that are fun and creative come with details. And how to get those details done is a way sometimes they come to you for coaching. And without going to jump into conclusions here about individuals, sometimes it's a matter of putting aside the right time to do these things or simply saying, you know what, these things are not my strength. I'm going to have someone else do them for me and just check them at the end. So we know people like that. We see them all the time. We run into them. And they're fun to be around. The high eye, always fun to be around. But what about at their worst? Well, at their worst, they come across as unorganized, unfocused, and maybe even a little bit shallow. While their stories are amusing, they often seem to center around the high eye themselves, with other people playing lesser, unimportant roles. Their work is haphazard. They don't routinely follow up on their assignments unless reminded to do so. Their overwhelming optimism leads to unrealistic and unachievable goals. They trust their employees to do the right thing without any regard for their employees' skill level. They're slow to acknowledge make hiring mistakes because of that, because of their unshakable faith in people around them. So, too bubbly, too energetic, impossible goals to make. You ask me to do some things here that I'm not qualified to do, and it makes me very uncomfortable. These things happen with a high eye. They believe people around them, regardless of what the talents are. Oh, you can do that. It's just a little bit of rocket science. You can handle that kind of stuff. Yeah, I'm an art history major. So they need to be corralled that way. Frank is our example here. He's excited about his new job in network planning department. Network planning. He knows he'll be rubbing elbows with some of the top executives in this company and making presentations to them on a regular basis, at least monthly. Now, when he got this office, it had all these, network maps all over the place, but that was ugly and boring. They had all those things removed, replaced with pictures of him with winning awards and meeting people. His engineers can worry about those network maps. That's not for him. He spent most of the morning planning a vacation in Mexico with a bunch of his friends. They had a great time together. I asked me on some boring conference call this afternoon, but figures that while he's doing that, he'll update his Facebook page. So what's Frank's challenge? He'll love making those presentations, but he sure hopes he doesn't get too many detailed questions about what those things mean, because he doesn't have much knowledge to go behind that. He only has so many hours of work before his personal life is going to take over. That's what he likes. And corporate will invite engineers at those meetings, so he has to do it on his own. But he figures, that's okay. I'll just wing it. Anybody here relate to that?
Yeah.
He's in a detailed position where things have to get done on a detailed level. Technical stuff is not his strength, doesn't want to be his strength. And he's going to try and wing it in front of a bunch of executives. Good luck with that, by the way. Yeah. So, again, like the D, there are these natural strengths that they're going to have. But if those strengths are misused, overused, or they're not a good match for the skills required, then it's going to be a big mismatch. Now, is it possible that Frank here could be a high eye, or maybe not Frank, maybe Frank Jr., can have that high eye behavior, but also have enough technical knowledge and detailed knowledge to be effective? Sure he can. But using the high eye skills for persuasion, have enough high C skills to understand the details, fairly unusual. But he's going to need help to figure out how he's going to manage some of these things, helping him learn how to answer the questions when he doesn't have the answers. Oh, crap. I'm short on time. I apologize. I'm going. I don't want to skip too quickly through here, but I also want to keep you guys late. I apologize. I rambled on a little bit.
That's okay.
High as a coach may not challenge the client to do more. They can be so enraptured with what they see going on that that's enough. It may not be enough. As a coach, they may want to tell their stories to make a point in the session rather than dealing with the client's stories.
Hmm.
They also may tend to just chat with a client rather than actually coaching them. So you lose the structure of the simple coaching model, for example, or you never get deep enough into what really is going on, but you've had a really nice conversation. The questions they ask may tend to be long and involved because they tend to speak before they think. On the coaching class, you guys were all taught, you know, pause, form the question, and then ask it. These folks may tend to ask questions as it's going through their mind, making it long and involved, and therefore indecipherable in some cases. And they won't be aware of how much they are talking versus listening, because they're used to talking. As a client, again, natural strengths, well, they're upbeat and optimistic. If you get a call with them, they're always going to be upbeat and optimistic. And when they're not, you're going to think something's really wrong. Wow, you're always so upbeat. What's going on here? They tend to be very open during the session. They don't hold things back. They don't try and mask things. They'll tell you everything. And that really makes coaching them a lot easier. They have some blind spots. That overly optimistic attitude is really a big issue with them. Yeah, I can solve this massive problem in 12 seconds. Watch this. Well, it's not that easy. Too optimistic. They also tend to have a lot of talk in the session about things they're going to do, but don't translate that into action. So being an accountability partner for a high eye is going to be a very big deal. They may not ask for it. They may reject it when you first offer it to them. But you may be persistent there over a few sessions, sit there and say, I'm seeing a pattern here. We talk about the things you're going to do. I don't hear them actually happening. Can I be your accountability partner? Can I hold you things? Also as a client, they are going to tend to avoid conflict. They don't like conflict. Now, they don't like conflict because as far as they're concerned, we're all buddies, we're all friends, and so we'll cover this conflict in like 3 or 4 second discussion, and it'll be over with, right? So not that they're afraid to address it, but they will address it in any kind of depth. And in a coaching conversation or dealing with conflict, they're not going to be direct. They tend to go off into the weeds someplace on these tangents. And coaching a high eye, I often hear, I ask a question, I get a seemingly unrelated answer. And I'll have to go back and say, here's my question again. Well, didn't you just ask that question? Yes, I did. Let me ask it again. And they don't realize they're doing that, but they do. Just with the coaching the high eye, too many number one priorities. Everything becomes number one. Everything's important. If we're going to all, it'll all be number one priorities. I once had a high eye come to me with his plan for his organization, and he had a series of goals for them. He had 67 goals for the organization. I said, which of these are the most important goals? And he said, they're all important. Which ones are the real big ones, though, that we're really going to focus on? Focus on all of them. Yeah. You laughed. His employees weren't laughing. They were They basically turned him off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like the high D, the blind spot can be here. They don't understand others' perceptions of them. They think because they're nice and outgoing and friendly that everyone loves them. And that can be true until they realize there's no depth there sometimes. And then people sit there and say, yeah, but you hung me out to dry. Or you didn't give me good direction. Or you asked me to create a nuclear bomb when I'm an art history major, and I can't do that kind of stuff. Likewise, as a client, they need to talk. They want to talk. You want to let them talk, but you got to keep it focused. They tend to go off into the weeds. Questions to ask the high eye. They like the question, how does this make you feel? Because they want to talk about their emotions, and that's really good. But you also need to ask them, what could go wrong here? Because they don't think about that. When you ask that question, again, they sit there and say, nothing, it'll all work out. Well, let's just slow down here. Suppose this, you do this, and this happens. Well, that won't happen. Well, let's just suppose it does. So they need to think about the alternatives and what can go wrong with their plans. Does it matter here what others think? Now, that question is important to a high I because they have a need, if you will, to be liked and popular. And sometimes you have to tell them, you know what, this is a hard decision. It doesn't matter what others think. It's your decision to make. And you can't have to do it based not on a consensus, but on what you think is right. When can you realistically accomplish this? Realistically is a big word there. They'll give you a target date. You know, I'll do it by tomorrow afternoon. Yeah, it's a three-week project. When can you really get this done? What's realistic here? And very important question for the high I, how will you know if it worked? They'll tell you if their actions are going to be, they haven't thought through the consequences or how they'll know if they were successful or not. So there's the high-level overviews of the D's and the I's. Fascinating behavioral styles, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yep.
They also tend to be rather easy to push out of a crowd, the D's and the I's. As we start our next session, we're going to do what we call a quick quiz on the different types of styles, and you'll discover it's very easy to pick out D's and I's out of a crowd. Not so easy with the S's and C's. We'll look at those in detail next week.
Mm-hmm.
Questions, comments?
Wow.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
That's so far so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is great.
Well, that's the D's and I's. We'll cover the S's and C's next week. And believe me, they are fascinating behavioral styles. Fascinating.
I have one question. Is it possible to be, like, we go high S's and high I's and stuff. Is it possible to be two equally? Where there isn't one that's dominant, one thing that's dominant, there you actually can relate to both of them identically?
To all four styles identically?
No, two. Because we're all combinations, right?
Right.
But yet one is called the high, which makes me think it's the stronger of the two. But is it possible that both your things are the same strength?
It is possible, yes. And as we talk about the blend of styles, you're going to see the mild variations caused by, for example, someone who is a DI versus an ID.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very
yeah,
close.
I read a little bit into those.
Oh, you've been sneaking ahead, have you?
Yep. Trying to figure out where I am in all this.
Well, so you're going to have all four styles inside of you, and there's usually one dominant style, But most people, not all, most, are going to have two dominant styles. And occasionally you'll see a third equally as strong.
Okay.
And that's when it gets really fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. That's exactly what I wanted to know. Yep.
Okay, good. All right, guys. Everyone have a great week. And again, if you need me and know where to find me, don't be afraid to call or write if you have questions or comments. But if not, I'll plan on seeing you guys all same time next week.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.